Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
I'm going to let you all in on a little Easter egg. In our film, Cats on the Internet, exactly 37 seconds in, a hand pops out of a computer holding a phone. And on that phone, there's a picture of a cat reaching into a fishbowl. Now, that cat might seem innocuous, but FedSoc stalwarts will recognize it as the photo that hangs on the wall in the office of the president of our illustrious organization, who is in fact a huge fan of felines. Greetings, and welcome back to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your cat-loving host. We made a film called Cats on the Internet about privacy in the digital age. I have here with me Amy Peikoff, Chief Policy Officer at BitChute and one of the speakers in our film. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a delight to have you back to talk with today. I'm really excited about our conversation here.
I'm really grateful that you made the film, which is bringing this issue to the awareness of a lot of people who I don't think knew about it before, and, you know, giving me a chance to take a little bit deeper dive than you can in a short film like that. So again, thank you.
Absolutely. So just to get us started off here, are you more of a cat person or a dog person?
You know what? I've got one of each. And just before we started recording, I had to go lock the cat in the other room so she wouldn't bother me during the recording. Cats are more recent for me. And I'm having an older barky dog. I'm appreciating the quieter cat. So maybe check with me in a little while.
All right. Fair enough. So what do you think of cats with a Z, as in the 1967 Supreme Court decision that redefined key terms for privacy?
Well, we have a short time to talk about that here, but that's a pretty loaded question. I wrote a dissertation on a whole framework for looking at privacy in which I talk about the reasonable expectation of privacy test of cats as being inherently pragmatic in the, you know, the philosophical sense. And I critique it heavily as an overall test in this realm. So that's it in a nutshell. People can go sort of deep dive into the articles that I've published in various law reviews about this, but I have one called Pragmatism and Privacy in particular, where I do a deep dive on that.
Gotcha. So it's more practical than not, rather than philosophically consistent?
Right. So the problem with pragmatism is that it has a standard of good that isn't objective. It ends up being some sort of what you might call intersubjectivity. If you go back to James, what he talks about is what is the standard of good. The good is anything that is demanded. So, you know, on a pragmatist standard, a leader who is trying to do well by the citizens would, I guess, add up all the various demands for different things and count that as good based on whether it's demanded. But I think you and I know that there are a lot of things that people demand that aren't objectively good for them. So that's kind of the core philosophical critique of pragmatism. But that was really quick. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. That sounds like it's a very deep and heady concept to really dig into.
And it's fun. And you know, again, it's really at the root of this whole topic of privacy, because, you know, many listeners will have gone to law school and will have been taught that the whole right to privacy originated with an 1890 law review article written by Warren and Brandeis and published in the Harvard Law Review. And in that article, they argued that you needed to have a distinct right to privacy, that the existing approaches based in property and contract were inadequate to protect our interests. But what they did is they erected this proposed right to privacy on an inherently pragmatist foundation. So really, that reasonableness standard where you say, does the person have a subjective expectation, i.e., do they demand privacy, right? And then the second prong is traditionally, is society prepared to recognize that expectation as reasonable, i.e. what does society demand, right? So you're balancing the demands. It's an inherently pragmatic standard, and it was from the get-go. And so those of us who are very strict about looking at the American system of law and proper systems of law generally as based in the principle of individual rights, we will have philosophical issues with that entire approach. And so, so much of my work has been in spelling out why Warren and Brandeis were wrong to propose a distinct right to privacy and why we should have stuck with property and contract all along. And it's that whole framework that actually led me to the solution to the problem of the third party doctrine, which is, you know, this arcane named doctrine that people glaze over when they hear the name third party doctrine. It's a real serious problem. It's the thing that caused all of the, you know, the bulk surveillance programs that were revealed by Snowden to be treated as legal. It's a very important doctrine, but a lot of people think, oh my gosh, this is so arcane, glaze over, whatever. When I looked at this doctrine and understood what it said, a solution sort of immediately fell out for me, because I had been for a long time looking at privacy through this lens of our traditional common law rights to property and contract. And, you know, again, like I said, rejecting the pragmatic approach that's inherent in that reasonable expectations test.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this third party doctrine. So what can you explain to someone who's just not familiar with it, what it is, and then what your solution is to work around it?
Sure. So the third party doctrine says that if you share information with a third party, and so that could be your telephone company, including your cell service provider, your bank, Starbucks when you swipe your little card and you buy coffee, social media companies, internet service providers, all the things that we do all day. Whenever you share information with a third party, this doctrine says that you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. And that phrase, reasonable expectation of privacy, is what the law currently uses as a trigger for Fourth Amendment protection. If you did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the information, then for the government to be able to obtain it, it would have to have a warrant based on probable cause, based on particularized suspicion. Unfortunately, that has not been the case since the 1970s. And it was in the 1970s that the Supreme Court took this third-party doctrine and transported it from its old context, which is the secret agent cases. I can explain that in a minute and also explain the significance of it. But the Supreme Court took it from that context over into a case where an ordinary customer is making a contract with an ordinary service provider, again, like your telephone, your bank, now social media companies, retailers, et cetera. And I believe that that was an error. And so what I do in my article, this one that's now getting a bit of play, thanks to Snowden and thanks to you at the Federalist Society, in that article, I just explain what the origins of this doctrine are, I believe, in terms of the common law. And when you understand it in terms of the origins in the common law, then a solution falls out, which is really that maybe the doctrine isn't necessary at all. Or if we are going to keep the doctrine, maybe at least recognize its origins in the common law, what is behind our feeling of reasonableness in those origins, and leave it at that. So I would propose overturning two Supreme Court cases from the 1970s. That's Smith and Miller. And that sounds very radical, but in, you know, a decade where we've now overturned Roe versus Wade already, I don't think it's that radical. I would propose overturning those two cases for the reasons I explain. And then we would actually make government get a warrant when it wants to obtain information from service providers.
Oh, that is really interesting. I think that definitely would change the landscape, wouldn't it?
I mean, I think it would reverberate in a bigger way than Roe versus Wade, but I might be a bit biased. And certainly there have been quite loud reverberations after Roe versus Wade being overturned.
Oh, no doubt about it. Now, in our film Cats on the Internet, you and Oren Kerr go back and forth about whether or not you can apply contract law to arrangements with third parties. So here's what he said. The text of the Fourth Amendment provides rights in your house, your person, your papers, your effects. If you want to make a contract with someone in which you try to deal with their person, their papers, their effects, the contract law can recognize that, but I don't think the Fourth Amendment recognizes it. What's your take on that?
So here's the thing. Contract is something that we use as an exercise of our rights to property, right? So I have, property rights in the wealth that I've created, et cetera, and I trade that with somebody else. We recognize certain types of contracts, certainly in Fourth Amendment law, leases for, apartments and things like that. And I would say that Cats, maybe itself is an implicit recognition that there's a certain contract that the person makes when he puts the quarter in the phone and et cetera. This is the thing, and this goes back to another fundamental philosophical issue. We can go for some sort of an originalist interpretation here, and there's original intent, there's original meaning that we could look at, but I tend towards Tara Smith's proposal, and probably others have joined her. She's a professor at UT, in critiquing originalism and saying that what we should do instead is look at the Constitution as embodying concepts. And so that what we need to do is look at how do the concepts of property or contract or persons, houses, papers, and effects, how would those concepts be used to embody the various entities and relationships that we have to describe and evaluate today. And so in brief, let me give you what is actually my contract-based critique of the third-party doctrine. It goes back to describing the secret agent cases. The secret agent cases you can think of as Tony Soprano is in the basement with his co-conspirator, and they're having this discussion about this illegal thing that they're agreeing to do. And of course, as part of the conversation that they're having, they are agreeing to keep this between themselves, right? They don't want to be found out. And, again, the third party doctrine arose in this sort of context. And the thought was, and it's very understandable, that those two do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the conversations that they have. Why is it though, right? What was described in the language of the third party doctrine is just, oh, well, once you share it with a third party, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. But I submit that there was more going on. And the more that was going on is that we know that the arrangement between those two is what the common law called an illegal contract. So it is a contract in which the, some significant piece of the consideration between the two was illegal, and the common law treated it as unenforceable, which would mean that their agreement to keep it secret would be unenforceable. And in my view, given the decades-long history of that doctrine being in that context, when you have these illegal arrangements and you have secret agents, et cetera, that's really what was behind the recognition that their expectation was not reasonable, and that the Supreme Court was not justified in transporting it to the sort of situation in which you and I are making agreements with our service providers. So, I do think that our Constitution embodies a principled understanding of the common laws underlying a lot of the concepts in there. And so I don't have this concrete bound understanding that if it's not a person, house, paper effect as understood by the framers at the time they drafted it, that somehow you're out of luck. I think these are, concepts and principles, and that those need to be thought of you know, in a way that allows for our expansion of knowledge and the expansion of the sort of lives we live.
Oh, that is interesting. So do you think that there is any sort of constitutional protection for third-party information?
Right. So what I do believe, and you know, I'm not the only person who has called for Smith and Miller to be overturned. What I am is the only person who has called for Smith and Miller to be overturned for exactly this reason and via this understanding, which is, a very controversial understanding. So yes, I believe that this information that's shared with third parties should not be able to be obtained by government from those third parties unless they are presented with a warrant based on probable cause, based on particularized suspicion, given that there are also exceptions to the warrant requirement for exigent circumstances, et cetera. Obviously, those would still apply, but otherwise, no, there should not be this routine bulk surveillance. Remember, Edward Snowden over 10 years ago revealed the fact that our government was routinely collecting huge databases of information about innocent Americans. And, much of that data that they were collecting and maybe still are collecting, you kind of wonder whether it would have run afoul of what the Supreme Court has already done in the Carpenter case in 2018. In 2018, the court has said that if there's 127 days of cell site location data, that somehow that does not fall under the third-party doctrine. It's a very narrow little carve-out, and a lot of people are trying to figure out what are going to be the longer-term implications. But on my view, that plus maybe, even what Warren Kerr has said about this case Rosenau that the court decided not to hear that has to do with preservation of data, orders to preserve data. I think there's a lot of indications that Smith and Miller are wrong. And then the question is, how do you actually overturn those cases in a way that can yield a principled bright line that everybody can use for guidance going forward? And I think the solution I propose, which is to, again, scale it back, say that, the secret agent case context is valid, but it is not valid to nullify the reasonable expectations of privacy that ordinary consumers have when they share information all day long and going about our daily lives. I mean, if you think about every little piece of information that you share with a third party each day and how many different third parties you share it with, and if the government could collect all of that and put a big picture about your activities in front of them, they could surveil you in effect. They'd be stalking you all day long. And that's something that I think none of us wants.
Absolutely. What you're describing definitely does sound reasonable.
I think it does, right? But the controversy around it is, again, that I come at it from this framework of property and contract based. So, for example, I went and reviewed this 10-year-old article of mine over the weekend, was looking at it. And not surprisingly, back then, I was also addressing Orrin Kerr's defenses of the doctrine. I was also looking at some critics of Kerr who critiqued his view of the doctrine, but from very different viewpoints. So for example, Kerr, you could say, is more of the pragmatist. He'll say that we need to balance the interests of someone who's being investigated versus society or the needs of law enforcement. He would say that maybe we need to remain neutral with regard to the level of privacy that somebody would enjoy in the state of new technology, et cetera. He seems either more of a pragmatist, or maybe you could think he's got some rule utilitarianism to him where he wants to have rules that create the greatest good for the greatest number, along those orders. In my article, I talk about Richard Epstein, who seems to favor more of what you would call an act utilitarian approach, which would be to look at things on a case-by-case basis and have a court look at things on a case-by-case basis in this realm. Then there's Erin Murphy, who comes at it from a more principled perspective, but she seems more what you might call traditionally left-leaning and wouldn't necessarily favor a strict contract-based approach, right? A lot of people were not very favorable about Lochner, for example. They don't want that era to come back. So, you know, again, I recognize that what I'm proposing here has controversial roots, but I think that once you understand the context of the secret agent cases from the lens that I explained, it's hard to argue with. And at the very least, I think people could agree about drawing the line with regards to the doctrine's application at that context and just recognize it's a common law and we don't necessarily apply it everywhere, but we could apply it here and recognize it as the root of the doctrine. One of the points that came up is that Kerr had mentioned that it would be difficult to determine in advance whether a particular contract was illegal, right? And, you know, if you go back to the doctrine of illegal contract in the common law, the key point was consideration. Was some of the consideration that was offered in the exchange illegal? And certainly, Facebook or your cell phone service provider or whatever is not bargaining for you, a customer, to use their service to commit a crime or, you know, fulfill some illegal purpose. So I would say it's safe to say that an ordinary service provider contract is not illegal and that, you know, again, it'd be very easy to apply what I'm suggesting to that context. Another thing that he had brought up was that the court has traditionally recognize this distinction between metadata, which is the data about data, and the content of communications. And he will cite Ex parte Jackson, which is an 1878 Supreme Court case. And I would distinguish that case from anything that, you know, we're talking about here today, Smith and Miller, et cetera, because in Ex parte Jackson, if you remember, the data was shared with the United States Postal Service, so it was shared with the government. And so a distinction that was drawn there, I wouldn't necessarily carry over to other contexts. Another thing that was talked about in the documentary was legislation versus litigation as a solution. And, you know, legislation is only as good as the latest batch of legislators and lobbyists and special interests and everything else. Obviously, a more durable solution is to be found in common law doctrine. And again, I think in an era where we've overturned Roe versus Wade, that what I'm calling for here isn't that radical and it would provide durable protection for our interests. And then I guess the last point is really just that sort of balancing approach. And I addressed a lot of that earlier from a philosophical perspective. The one point I did want to hit before maybe we closed here was the premise that we should maintain neutrality, a consistent level of privacy with respect to the various levels of technology that come up. So what Kerr is proposing is that if there is new technology or other, you know, lifestyle enhancements that we have that would afford more privacy for us, perhaps we should favor a Fourth Amendment doctrine that would keep our level of privacy about the same as what has traditionally been enjoyed. And I want to question that premise entirely. You know, I've been influenced in a lot of my thinking, although Rand did not talk very much about privacy. She didn't say a whole lot about it, very, very little. But, you know, I've been influenced in my overall thought by her philosophically. And Ayn Rand wrote in The Fountainhead, civilization is the progress toward a society of privacy. And that always stuck with me because you would think, yes, as we become more civilized, and it's been true throughout history, right? We have more privacy now than we have when, you know, multiple families would live in the same home, for example, out of poverty, et cetera. But I don't see any reason why that shouldn't continue. And again, you know, for me, the touchstone is always looking at the concept of individual rights and applying it within new contexts. And, you know, I don't think we should give up on doing that as thoughtfully as we can and preserving our rights in the process.
Definitely a lot of food for thought there. Well, thank you, Amy, for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much again for giving me the opportunity just to share this important topic with people and hopefully advocate for a solution.
Absolutely. This is definitely one of the more important ones we got there today. Thank you, folks, for listening in. You can find our film, Cats on the Internet, on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.